to Facebook.
Blog Talk Radio.
Yep.
There we go. This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
All right.
Thank you, bus people. Thank you. Thank you.
Had some rain flow through here today, but it's past now, so they seem to be pretty happy. I'm going to get right into our guest because he's limited on his time tonight. He can't stay with us the full hour, so I don't want to delay too long. He's in our green room right now enjoying our snack layout for him, but we'll have to pull him out of that and get him out here onto the show. Hello, Matt. Welcome to All About Wine.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing really well, thank you. So, you are a sake sommelier.
Yeah.
How does one get to be a sake sommelier as opposed to a wine sommelier?
Well, I started out as a wine sommelier, and I work in New York City. I'm the head sommelier at Joji, which is a Michelin-starred sushi omakase in One Vanderbilt, right by Grand Central. And so my first exposure to sake was at a wine shop a couple years ago. We had a pretty varied kind of selection of things, of bottles, and we did have a dedicated kind of sake program. So I was interested in it a little bit and learned a bit there. But through fate, I was kind of thrown into this restaurant, into Joji. Just kind of grappled with it and fought through trying to learn this whole new beverage and category. So I learned about it much of the way I learned about wine, through reading, tasting, just asking the questions of people far more intelligent than me. And eventually got a sake certification. It's called Kiki Sakeshi in Japan, but the English language version of that is called the International Kiki Sakeshi. And there's courses throughout there as well that teach you about the history of sake, how it's made, classifications and types, pairing, tasting as well. And there's exams similar to, you know, wine exams through the Court of Master Sommeliers or what have you.
Wow. You are a wine sommelier then? You certified?
Yeah. So okay. I have both sides of that coin, sake and wine, which is great.
Okay. So what, before we get into the restaurant, what's your journey up to this point? I mean, have you been involved with wine since you were, before you were old enough to drink, or is it something that you acquired in college? Or what is your journey to?
So I grew up in New Jersey, and my dad actually worked in the wine industry. So I was always around it. He was a wine buyer for restaurants like Tavern on the Green in the 70s, and I was born in the 90s, and so I was always surrounded by wine and a love and a passion for it. I didn't come to it through him, but when I kind of naturally developed the curiosity after college, he was a great resource and gave me a first few books, and we would taste and drink together and kind of started this love affair. It was a lovely thing to, new thing to bond over in my 20s with him, and it's led me to this whole career. So I was exposed to a lot of great wines at a job that I had after college, eventually wanted to do it more full time. And so I started working at this great wine shop in Tribeca called Verve Wine. And it was a great first wine job that exposed me to sake and, you know, a host of amazing producers and whatnot. I was there for the whole pandemic. And then coming out of there, I wanted to move more to the restaurant side of things. So worked with a couple great restaurants in New York City. There's no shortage of great restaurants in New York City with amazing mentors who kind of led me to this point.
Fantastic. All right. Yeah, you're right. There's, you know, finding a restaurant in New York City is a pretty easy thing to do. I was talking to my son earlier today. And I told him that you were going to be a guest and you were a sake sommelier. And he goes, oh, ask him. And so he rattled off about four or five questions for me to ask you about sake. So I told him I would. Okay. Number one, at what temperature is best to serve sake?
Oh, sure. So sake has this interesting kind of layer compared to wine that you can serve it at a whole host of temperatures. Chilled down to something you would drink, maybe a champagne or a white wine at, or warm to something maybe you'd have, you know, hot chocolate. Sometimes. And everything in between, you know, also room temperature sake as well. But essentially, it boils down to the style of sake that you're using. So maybe we can talk more about the way sake is made and classifications. But maybe a more coarsely polished sake, so a sake that has more inherent kind of ricey or grain-driven characters, flavors, aromas, more of this kind of robust textural component to it. Often those lend themselves really well to being warmed up. But on the other hand, if you have really delicate, high-toned, fruity styles of sake, if you warm them up, you would kind of blow off all these pretty characteristics you're trying to enjoy. So often for those, it'd be great to serve in a white wine glass at a white wine temperature. So it really depends on the style of sake, but there's a whole range of things.
Well, you said, let's get back to the beginning. That was another question he had about the rice. And sake is made from rice. So he asked, what type of rice? Do you have special sake rice? Or can it be made out of brown rice? Or, there's a range of rice out there that's as wild as there's a range of grapes. And so he was questioning that, which, you know, these are questions I was going to ask anyway, but I'll give him credit because he asked me. So you said yes when I said sake rice. There is a rice used just for sake?
Yes, there are sake mane, so specific sake rice that are used in the brewing of sake that have often been developed for their innate abilities to be easily used in the brewing of sake. So you're not going to see, you know, a basmati sake. You want kind of rice that has a really kind of well-defined starchy center. So the most popular sake rice you'll ever see is called Yamada Nishiki. It's often referred to as the king of sake rice. And it was developed specifically in the 30s. And it's widely used today across all of Japan, across all of the world, for its ease in brewing sake. It's so easy to work with. It's kind of like the Chardonnay of the sake world, right? Like you can do whatever you want to it. You can use stainless steel and get a really sharp style of Chablis, Chardonnay, what have you, or you can have a really kind of lush, malolactic, oakier, tropical example. So you can kind of do the same thing with Yamada Nishiki and make a whole host of whatever kind of style you're trying to make. The tricky thing with sake rice is it's not as clear cut as wine grapes are. So it's not often so like, you can't, you know, maybe if you're like a experienced wine taster, you can pick out a Sauvignon Blanc from a Chardonnay, from a Viognier, right? These are very different styles aromatically, texturally, and it's not as clear-cut in sake. It's not. There are some that are noted for their kind of distinctive nature, but often it's really tough to kind of pick out what sake rice is used. And so often, the Yamada Nishiki, the best examples of it are grown in this prefecture in Japan called Hyogo. And it's expensive. It's the king of sake rice. And so brewers will buy up this rice and have it shipped to wherever their brewery is to make their examples. So it's not even necessarily that the rice is a locally grown rice native to their region or prefecture. So it can be tricky. They do have some differences, notably omachi rice. Omachi rice is another super popular rice in the sake world that has kind of this inherent savoriness, earthiness, contrasting with maybe the more high-toned fruity characteristics of commonly made Yamada Nishiki sake. So there are some differences, but it's much tougher to tell than just two different wine grapes.
Huh. That's fascinating. You mentioned the areas that they were growing. Is there specific areas that certain rices are growing? I mean, that you can pretty much count on those being decent rice, or can you grow very good rice anywhere?
Yeah, so I mean, there are special plots designated within Hyogo, for example, that are designated as Toku A, Toku meaning special, like specially designated plots. You can, I mean, maybe think of it as Kummer Fru or Grand Fru kind of level in quality that are just known to year after year produce the best examples. And yeah, you can't necessarily grow it everywhere, and you can't grow every type of rice everywhere. So there's another region in northern Japan. The region is Niigata, and they are famous for a type of rice called Goyaku Mangoku. It's a very long name, but essentially, you can't really grow Yamada Nishiki up there. It's so cold that it's just you're not able to. It doesn't thrive. And so this is a Goyaku Mangoku is a hardier rice that thrives in those kind of colder climates. And actually, it's another great example of a kind of distinct style of sake. Produces a very lean, sharp, less aromatic style of sake that is super popular, I should mention. For someone who just wants something kind of light, dry, sake made with Goyaku Mangoku rice often kind of gives you that characteristic. That's the thing you only really find up north.
Would that be served chilled also, or is that one of those that serve warmer? Chilled?
No, that would generally be one I would serve. I mean, well, honestly, it depends. You totally could serve that warm or chilled. Often it's a matter of personal preference as well as setting. So you kind of get the culture of warming up sake from the brewery workers. So brewery workers would often make sake in the wintertime. So it was just a natural thing that they would do to, you know, sit around the fire, drink some sake, but they don't want to drink something ice cold. It is a style of sake you could do either way because it's not quite as aromatic. Of the times when I serve it, it is chilled, but to be fair, you could do both.
Well, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you lose your aromas when it's warmer, and you just mentioned that didn't
it's
have
not
a whole lot
aromatic,
of,
exactly.
Yeah, you know, so that's why I was,
exactly.
You know, doing it. Louisiana grows rice. Would these rices be able to grow in Louisiana?
There is a ton of Yamada Nishiki that is grown in Arkansas.
Oh, really?
That is, yeah. I'm not quite sure about Louisiana, although I'm probably. But I know Arkansas is a big producer of the Amada Nisiki, and there are breweries in the U.S., notably, at least in my neck of the woods, Brooklyn Kura is a brewery in Brooklyn that uses a lot of Arkansas rice, as well as Sapphire Blue is a new brewery. It's kind of the American wing of Dasai, which is a famous brewery in Japan in Yamaguchi. So they just opened recently, and they use some domestically grown rice as well. So yeah,
wow.
I'm certainly again.
That's interesting. I
yeah.
Would never consider that, you know, we have some good rice growing like in Arkansas. That surprises
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
Like wine. Well, tell us, and this is interesting because, again, when I was talking to my son, I mentioned that rice is growing in water and all that, and he wasn't fully aware of how that worked. For the listeners who are unsure, how is rice planted and grown and harvested?
So, I mean, rice paddies are these kind of shallow water beds with often these kind of clay soils. But it's planted every year. It's kind of notable, especially if you come from the wine world. There are no, like, old vine rice. Rice is planted
right.
every year, harvested every year. That's essentially how they do it. I mean, it's all the details of the complexity of how they're brewing. That's not necessarily my exact forte. But yeah, they're planted in these kind of shallow water beds. And the rice gets very tall. I mean, it can get meters tall. And it's super susceptible to winds and all kinds of climatic elements. So the type of rice that you can plant in a certain region is super susceptible to that temperature as well. And yeah.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Well, you know, like I say, it's just, I'm sure people, not everyone understands how rice is planted and harvested. So just a simple explanation was great. Again, we're going back to growing. Does soil make a difference in rice, or is it just the plant itself?
No, soil doesn't make a difference.
Okay.
I mean, also, which also kind of plays into, like I mentioned, those kind of Kokue sites, those like specially designated sites that grow higher quality rice that command a higher price year in, year out. So yeah, it's similar to wine. There's soil elements, there's diurnal considerations, so the temperature change between day and night, aspects, I believe, as well. But yeah, it's certainly site dependent. The difficulty is, you know, sake has been brewed for so long, right? They're making fermented rice beverages for hundreds and hundreds of years. But thinking of it in terms of kind of the way you would talk about wine, like
right.
an element of terroir, is
right.
newer, and maybe even often against kind of the natural inclinations of Japanese culture. That it's not really something the way people often think about it. It's growing. It's growing. So there are certain regions that have kind of regional distinctions and expectations. But it's very different than, you know, say Burgundy. You know, like there's no Jasper Morris of the sake world that's saying like this site gives you, you know, this kind of quality, which is inherently different than the site next to it. So like I mentioned, often people will buy this great Yamada Nishiki and then ship it or train it to wherever they are so that they can make their best example of sake possible. Go ahead.
This was going to wrap up.
So any kind of, any kind of like a regional designation or kind of a difference often comes down to water. So the water source is hugely important. Often water is kind of equated to terroir in sake, more than necessarily where the rice is grown. Japan is like specially designated like sacred water, the special waters.
Wow.
That all have different, you know, mineral compositions, and some are more mineral dense, harder waters that tend to produce drier, sharper styles of sake. And some places have softer waters that gives you kind of more of a textural, lush, round, silky style of sake.
Oh,
there was actually, me and the chef went to Japan in January. Obviously, this beautiful restaurant, or sorry, this beautiful hotel in Kyoto. And this hotel had bottled fushimizu, which is, fushimizu is this one of the famous sake brewing waters that I'd read about in books and learned about. And then I show up to this hotel, and it's just bottled water. It's just the local bottled water. And it was so delicious. It was the greatest water I've ever had.
Really?
Smuggled back a ton of bottled water. it's really delicious. So that kind of plays a big element as well, the water source.
Oh, okay. So can sake be made out of any rice, or would you want to? Obviously, you wouldn't want to, but could it be made out of any rice?
I think technically, yeah. It's not like Burgundy, where you can only make it out of Pinot Noir. You could brew it out of anything. You just need this starch component converted to sugar with the use of koji, which is it's the national mold of Japan, and it is kind of similar to malt in the beer making process. It is the catalyst that converts starch to sugar so you can ferment it.
Oh,
so you have starch and koji and yeast and water, at the very least, you should be able to make sake. If it'll be super delicious, that's the question.
Why would you want to?
Yeah. Exactly.
You're not going to pick up a box of Uncle Ben's and make sake. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You have to leave here soon. So, tell me about the restaurant. Tell me, when you got on there. All about the restaurant.
Okay, so Joji is a tsuchiyamakase, small intimate tsuchiyamakase in One Vanderbilt in New York City. We opened just about 2 years ago. Got a Michelin star our first year.
Wow.
It's the brainchild of three chef partners who had worked together for many, many years at Masa, which is a three Michelin star omakase in New York, kind of a very legendary restaurant in that kind of way. So they took a ton of sushi making experience, as well as culinary experience from Love Madison Park and a host of other restaurants to kind of create this concept. So it's very small, it's very intimate, but it's very fun. There's all 90s hip hop playing throughout the whole meal. And it's a very intimate experience. I mean, one of the chefs I know, he talks about going to an omakase is like going to someone's home. And you sit at them with a table and you are having a conversation with the chef all night. And often with me, whatever sommelier is there. And it's really kind of a relationship building dynamic. And to that point, when guests come back, we change the menu for them. So they come back to the restaurant, we look at when they were here last, what they ate on that given day, and we change it for them.
Oh,
so they'll be sitting at the counter, they notice someone else has a completely different menu, and they may be feeling a little jealous, and it's just, they've had what you've had. And we want people to keep, they want people to be engaged and not get bored. And so it's an amazing, very personal place in that kind of respect. And we have a great beverage program. So it's a big list containing a ton of sake, as well as wine, white burgundy, champagne, red burgundy, Loire Valley, everything.
Yeah.
But the main categories we usually focus on, though, that are most often ordered are sake, white burgundy, red burgundy, and champagne.
Sake you mentioned champagne. Is there a sparkling sake?
There is, actually. Yeah. Called Awa sake. It's kind of a newer category, only maybe in the last 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And so there are some bottle conditions, that's the term they use, sakes that are have a second fermentation in the bottle. It's not quite like champagne, and it's still a newer category. So it's I've noticed some bottle inconsistency in some from a host of producers. Some are drier, some are sweeter, some have exploded as I tried to open them. but it's kind of a crazy moment. On the floor,
yeah,
it was all over the counter.
Yeah,
yeah, it was wild. There is sparkling sake. It is a newer category, and I'm excited to see how it grows and changes. Yeah. There were brewers that made sparkling sake just for the Tokyo Olympics because they wanted something festive and they didn't want to use champagne. They're like, "Oh, we're for Japan. We should make something within ourselves." So, but yeah, there's really, I mean, there's so many styles of sake and like. And it's so different than wine. It's really fun and playful.
I have a couple of bottles of sake in my wine rack here. I always try to keep one or two bottles and rotate them and drink them. What is a reasonable price line for sake? I mean, a decent sake is going to cost you what? $50?
In a retail environment, sure. I think that would be a good number. I mean, it's like wine, right? You can name a number, the biggest number you can think of. There's probably a bottle that costs that much, but there's a lot of more everyday bottles as well. But let's say, yeah, if you're looking for a good bottle of sake, in a retail environment, maybe around 50, 40, something like that.
No, that's not too bad.
30. Yeah, it's not too bad. In a restaurant, like. With wine as well, prices do go up, but
right, about three times.
But yeah, and that's kind of I think my point. I'll mention this briefly before I gotta get off. Because sake can be so driven by process and all these technical elements of how it's made, and you can get so in the weeds and just get a little lost in what an actual glass is gonna taste like and what to expect. So if I had to say one thing. One like piece of advice to someone who is interested in trying sake, I would say if you go to a restaurant or a sake shop where people are knowledgeable and have good experience, just say a price point you're looking for that you want to spend. And if you don't know anything, just say, "Hey, I want to try a bottle of sake. Whatever you're excited about or you think is particularly delicious, I'm open." All right,
there
and it may
go.
Be sweeter than you expected. It may be drier, it may be fruitier, it may be more savory, but just be open to trying it, because sometimes people will get so lost and they're like, "I just want something dry, 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 dry," and they're shutting themselves down to a whole world of really delicious flavors that are really prized and often the most premium examples of sake, but might be a smidge off dry. And in my point of view, maybe even a more balanced product. Or if you really want to learn about styles of sake, again, go to a place, go to a restaurant, say, "Hey, I want to spend, I don't know, $100, $150, whatever it is," and say, "Hey, but I want a great example of a Junmai sake, or I want a great example of a Junmai Ginzo sake, or a Junmai Daiginzo sake at this price point," and use that as the vehicle for learning about it, because if you just try to read about it, it'll be so tough. It's like learning about sherry. It's so process driven. It's so complicated that just take it slow, be open to trying something new, and go from there.
Yeah, there you go. And the first thing he'll do is laugh at me because I pronounce those names completely wrong. And
yes, Daiginzo. Daiginzo. Everyone says Daiginzo. Yeah, no, Daiginzo.
Guy Ginzo. Okay.
Guy Ginzo.
All right. I'll still pronounce it wrong. Matt,
okay.
Thank you for taking the time. Before you leave, give us contact information for the restaurant. So if anybody's in New York and they're so inclined, they can try to get reservations.
Yes. So the restaurant is Joji, J-O-J-I. Reservations are available on Resy. And you can visit our website, Joji NY, J-O-J-I-N-Y.com. For more information, we have the Omakase restaurant, which is more of a, you know, special occasion, high-end experience, but we also have a takeout concept for grab-and-go sushi boxes called Joji Box as well. So something at every price point, for sure.
Fantastic. Thank you
for
taking the time to
Thank
join
you
us
so
tonight
much.
And educating us a little bit on sake. I enjoy sake. I've been drinking it for years, and along with my wine, and so it's good to know some of these things about it, and I'm sure my son thanks you for the information, too. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Have yourself a good evening, and if I'm ever in New York, I'll look you up.
Please do. Please do. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
And you too now. Bye. All right. Sorry, Mike, I didn't ask you if you had any questions for him. He had to...
Oh, that's all right. He was limited time.
Yeah, he was. He was limited time tonight.
Yeah.
That was interesting stuff about sake. I didn't know there. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, a special rice that makes the best sake? Who knew? Yeah. So, if my son's listening to it, Ryan, there you go. I hope that answers your questions. But, Ryan, don't leave yet. Because I happened to find a website that talked about sake, and I want to go through that and tell people a little bit more about it. Some of the things that Matt did not cover. This is off the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, which is the WSET, which you can get certification on this and all that through this. They offer wine certifications and all. This is from their website. And it's about sake, some essential tips and stuff. So I found this, and since I knew Matt was going to be limited on time tonight because he had an engagement he had to get to, I kept it out so I can go through this. First, storing sake at home. Don't put it in heat or strong light. Again, a lot like wine on that. You want to keep it stored properly so that you don't destroy it if you're going out and buying yourself a bottle of sake. For short-term storage, sake should be kept in cool conditions, which is around 54 degrees Fahrenheit, 12 degrees Celsius, and ideally refrigerated at 46 degrees Fahrenheit. Refrigeration is especially important for unpasteurized sakis called Namazake, N-A-M-A-Z-A-K-E, and also for the very fruity Ginjo styles of sake, or Ginjo, G-I-N-J-O with long O, Ginjo. If left unrefrigerated, unpasteurized sakis can develop off aromas, and Ginjo styles of sake can lose their delicate freshness. So there you go. It's not, be sure whatever you're buying, if you're going to store it, then be sure it's stored properly. Store the bottles upright. They're best stored upright to avoid contact with the liquid on the closure. The closure is usually a foil line stopper or a metal screw cap. And so you don't want the sake in contact with that. So store the bottle standing up. And avoid bright lights on it. Keep it away from sunshine or any artificial bright lights. The heat and the light can cause the sake to develop unpleasant aromas and even a bitter taste. And this can also cause the sake to become a darker color, starting to change color and get darker. Basically, drink it young. Most sakes are intended to be consumed within a year of being shipped from the brewery. So if you're picking up one in the liquor store and you're getting a Japanese sake, you know, subtract a month or two from that because it's going to take a while for it to get to the store before you buy it. And this is especially true for unpasteurized sake, the Namazeki, and the Jinzo style. And again, those are the ones that I just mentioned above. Once opened, a sake bottle should be sealed and stored in a refrigerator and drink it within 2 weeks. So once it's open, put the cap back on it. Most sake bottles I've had have a screw cap on it. I don't think I've had any with a cork. That doesn't mean that there aren't some out there with corks, but I don't think I've picked up one that has a cork in it. So put the screw cap back on the top and put it in the refrigerator, drink it within 2 weeks. It starts going bad, and it will go bad. There's different faults that you can find. Check it. Be sure that it doesn't have any of the faults. There's four of them you should look for. Oxidation. A bottle of sake, and this is whether you've stored it or open it brand new. These are all faults you should look for. A bottle of sake that has been open or stored for too long or stored at too high a temperature loses its fresh aromas and becomes out of balance. And Matt just mentioned that too, that you want to keep it nice and fresh. It can eventually develop pungent aromas of pickled vegetables. Also, the color changes and starts becoming a much deeper, darker color. That's what happens when air gets too oxidized. Out of condition or unpasteurized sake. Unpasteurized sake that has been kept refrigerated or been kept for too long can develop unattractive malt, bacon, and meat aromas. In some instances, other extremely unpleasant aromas can develop. I don't know. I mean, bacon? That can't be that bad if you start getting a bacon aroma. Well, for sake, I suppose so. Next condition is light damage. Sake that has been exposed to strong light can develop unpleasant aromas like scorched rubber and burnt hair. This can come up after a few days of exposure to light or artificial light. That's why when you go into a store, liquor store or a wine shop or anywhere, I don't like artificial lights. Artificial lights tend to play havoc on wines and sockers. You need to have this, the sake needs to be in a darker place as do wines. And, you know, fluorescent lights and artificial lights, these, check the fluorescent lights are not good. The UVs from the fluorescent lights are horrible on wines. Regular lights are better, but they don't, you don't want them to have high wattage. You want something a little bit smaller, lower wattage. So that way it doesn't give off a lot of strong light. With the new light we have now, that's much, much better that they're using those as opposed to the previous ones that just sort of like burned right through the bottle. But if you go into a store and you see these things under lights, or a lot of times around the front of the store with the windows and stuff like that, avoid that stuff. That's why you find liquor stores that don't have a whole glass front to the store because of the sun shining in, unless they're north-south facing, and then they cuss down on that light problem there on that. And the fourth problem that you can run across is microbial spoilage. While these other faults covered here develop after sake has left the brewery, microbial spoilage is something that happens in the brewery. It can result in a wide range of unpleasant aromas, such as rotting vegetables, compost, sour milk, rancid cheese, and even sticking plaster. And they refer to the sticking plaster as like the Band-Aid smell. Sticking, you know, that's some of those sounds like Brett aromas there. All right. How to serve sake. I thought this was interesting. I read this before, and I thought this was interesting. Sake can be served from the bottle, but it is also common to decant it into a small sake carafe, such as a Tokori or a Karaguchi. I wonder how badly I destroyed those. Too bad Mastodon's here to laugh at me. If you want to serve sake in an authentic Japanese way, keep the following points in mind. Your pouring etiquette. In Japan, pouring etiquette is rather specific. Try to pour sake with both hands by holding the neck of the bottle as much as you can. Like a baseball bat, though. The person receiving the sake should hold their cup with two hands, too. Using both hands shows the most respect and care for the other person. So you have to hold the bottle rested on your hand on the neck and grab it from the back and pour it that way, two hands. When pouring for others, has a very important meaning in Japanese culture. This is the main reason sake cups are made so small. Regularly topping up each other's glasses allows people to show that they care for each other while sharing sake together. However, you should let your customers or guests serve themselves if they insist. So it's a sign of respect and caring to pour someone's sake for them. All right, serving sake at the correct temperature. Here's something I asked Matt about. He explained it. Let me go through it again. Part of the unique and appealing culture of sake that can be enjoyed at a wide range of temperatures, from very chilled to room temperature and even warm. And that's what shocked me. While some sakes are equally enjoyable, very chilled, 41 to 59 degrees, room temperature, 59 to 64, or warm, 104 to 131 degrees Fahrenheit. 131 degrees Fahrenheit? I read that and I'm going, what? You're going to burn your tongue. Okay, that's what it says here, and I guess the listener knows what it's talking about. With all sake styles, there can be a risk of overchilling or overheating. Overchilling can cause the aromas in the sake to seem less pronounced. Matt brought that. Overheating can cause the sake to lose its complexity or of flavor. He brought that up also. For example, some spicy hojazu sakes can be heated up to 50 to 55 degrees centigrade or 122 to 131 degrees Fahrenheit. But any warmer than this could mean there is a risk that the complex sake flavors will be lost, leaving only the flavor of alcohol behind. Okay, there you go. So still 131 degrees Fahrenheit. I have a hard time finding something that warm. Finding something that warm being enjoyable. If you're ever in doubt about the correct service temperature, simply refer back to this handy chart. And the handy chart is as follows. I wonder if I can put this on the... Maybe I can put all this on the Facebook page, this whole article. I don't know. I'll try. Recommended temperatures for different styles of sake. And the Tsushu... Junmai and Jozo should not be real chill, but all the others are good. 41 to 50, too cold, but all the others 50 on up is good. Pure fruity styles of Jinjo is what it is. Very chilled. Room temperature maybe, but not too warm. Fuller bodied styles of Jinjo, Komoto, and Yamaha. Not too cold. Yes, okay, just chilled, 50 to 59. Yes, 59 to 64. And yes, 104 to 131 degrees. Sparkling sake. Here we are. Very chilled, but that's it. You don't want it any warmer. And Kochu and Nigori sake, not so much very chilled, but all the other categories, you can keep it at that. So I'll try to put this up on the website. Which did you drink sake out of? Sake can be served in a range of vessels depending on the sake style and temperature it should be served at. So there you go. You're not going to remember this. Nobody remembers this stuff. Wine glasses. Wine glasses are ideal for serving premium sake with Jinjo aromas, either chilled or at room temperature. Room temperature always gets me. They say room temperature, and it just depends on who's living in that house. My engineer likes to keep our house at about that of a meat locker, so you don't want to serve some of these at that temperature. So, I don't know. The most suitable glasses are small enough that the sake stays at the right temperature while it is being consumed, and tulip-shaped to enhance the aromas. Ochoko, O-C-H-O-K-O. This is the Japanese word for a traditional sake cup. These come in a range of sizes, shapes, and materials. The most common types are small pottery or glass cups that have a flat base. The small size means they must be frequently refilled, reflecting the tradition of Japanese hospitality. Remember I read you that at the beginning. It is also ideal for warm sake because the small size means that sake is more likely to stay warm in the cup. Kikichoko. This is a specific type of ochoko. It is made of white pottery and has concentric blue circles painted on the inside on its flat base to help sake judges and brewers assess the color and haziness of a sake. These vessels were developed for use in competitions. Oh, well, that's interesting. And let's see. Masu, M-A-S-U. This is the Japanese word for a small box made of Japanese cedar. It is not an ideal sake drinking vessel because the wood taints the sake and the square shape is extremely difficult to drink out of. However, in Japan, sake is sometimes drunk out of masu on ceremonial occasions. Historically, they were used for measuring out rice and sake. It is also very common to transfer sake from the bottle into a small carafe to make it easier to pour it into small ochoku cups. Two common examples of sake carafes are Tokuri and Katakuchi. Tokuri come in a range of sizes and can be made from a variety of different materials. A typical Tokuri has a narrow top and a flat base. The most common are about 150 to 300 milliliter, which is only 5 to 10 U.S. fluid ounces, and made of pottery. Glass Tokuri sometimes have a small compartment for ice water to keep a chilled sake cool. Well, that'd be cool. Katakuchi is a service vessel used for chilled sake. It is a shallow open bowl with a lip at one end. There you go. That's WSET Global. Let's see. What is this? How to... this is a blog. Essential tips for sake storage and what is this? Oh, here we go. How to become sake savvy. Essential tips for sake storage and service. How to taste wine. The best way to reserve wine. Ideal for top stories. How to read a wine list in a restaurant or bar. Let's just say about sake. Since we're having a sake night here. Okay, this is just what I read. All right, we don't need to read that again. That is just what I went through. Okay, let's back up to Sake 101 and let's see what this says. Oh, W said it's a new sake course. Can educate and inspire students. This just came out on March the 27th, so this is a rather new course. Here's how to build a sake career. A couple different ones, I'm sure, sake sommeliers. There's another one yet, and yet another. So four different, I'm sure, sake sommeliers that tell you how to build a sake career. That's interesting. Let's go back here. What is sake? A beginner's guide. We know what sake is. We just learned it. How to build a career. Okay, here, this looks interesting. Sake industry jargon. That's what this... Okay. Oh, this looks interesting. Wait here, let me share this with you. I don't know if we have enough time, but this looks like this might be interesting. Koji. K-O-J-I with a long O. This refers to one of the key ingredients in sake. It's a type of mold or fungus called koji ken, which is grown on steamed rice grains, releasing enzymes to help turn rice starch into sugar. Many ingredients in Japanese food, including soy sauce, mirin, miso, and rice vinegar, are also fermented with koji. Sake producers cultivate special strains of koji for each style of sake by adjusting temperatures, moisture levels, and batch size. Very good. That was something I was curious about. Umami. Here we go. One of the five basic tastes. It's hard to describe, but it's a meaty, savory taste. It's also found in high levels in seaweed and fermented and aged foods such as mature seeds, cheeses, dried mushrooms, and soy sauce. One of the factors that makes sake's flavor different from any other alcoholic drink is the presence of umami. Although now umami is in wine, so that's not the only alcoholic drink umami's in. It is in wine. Umami flavors tend to be most pronounced in the junmei category of sakes. Polishing ratio. Sake brewers start with whole grains of brown rice. So they do use brown rice. They then slowly remove the outer layers of rice in a mechanical rice, polishing machine so that it becomes white rice. They can then continue to polish the rice, removing the middle layers. The extent to which they remove layers is called the polishing ratio. The polishing ratio is the percentage of white rice remaining in the center of the rice grain after polishing. If the polishing ratio is 40%, then 60% of the outer and middle layers of the rice have been removed. The polishing ratio has a significant impact on the style of sake produced. If the brewer decides to remove almost all layers, leaving just the core, almost pure starch, then the resulting sake will typically have purity and more fruity floral aromas. Whereas if a brewer only polishes away some of the middle of rice layers, then the resulting sake will have more complexity and umami flavors with cereal and lactic aromas. Huh. How about that? You can have 100%, which is still got the layers, 70%, 60%, 50%, and 35%, which makes the rice look like a little ball. Okay. Jinju. Jinju refers to one of the two main types of premium sake. Jinju sakes have to have a polishing ratio of 60% or less. Jinju sakes typically have pure floral and fruity aromas such as melon, apple, pear, rose, and aniseed. These aromas are called jinjoka, which means jinjo aroma. Kir. When tasting wine, a long-lasting finish indicates a good quality wine. However, in the world of sake, it is a short, clean finish that demonstrates quality. Kir, I guess I will pronounce it kir. Kir is the Japanese word for a clean, crisp, cleansing finish. When you drink sake with kir with food, it acts like a sorbet, removing flavors and refreshing the palate. Achieving a kir finish in a sake is a great skill. Too bad we couldn't have Matt on longer. He could explain a lot of this stuff to us, but he had to go. Shinshu. Shinshu literally means new sake. Most brewers only make sake between autumn and spring and early summer. Shinshu sakes are released around mid-November to early December after the first press has been completed. Shinshu sakes are unpasteurized and are only available until early summer at the latest, as they are extremely sensitive to the heat and maturation, which occurs much more rapidly compared with pasteurized sake. These sakes have an extremely fresh, lively, and expressive taste with a lingering finish. Shinshu. And Koshu. Koshu refers to sakes that are aged for long periods. As it ages, sake evolves to medium or deep gold, amber, and even brown color without any oak contact. Aging creates richness and complexity, as well as encouraging the development of aromas such as caramel, toffee, molasses, and nut. Some earthy vegetable notes, mushrooms, soy sauce, cabbage, and radish can also develop. And the last one, Kuramoto. Kuramoto means sake brewery owner in Japan. The philosophy and technique of a Kuramoto are key determining factors in a sake style and quality. I'm just going to ask Matt about, you know, if they have any names for those who brew sake or make it. There are just over 1,200 Kuramoto in Japan today, although the numbers are declining every year. Traditionally, a Kuramoto owned their business and a seasonally hired toji, or master brewer, managed the brewing. However, recently there is a trend towards Kuramoto toji, a younger generation of business owners who are also master brewers. All right. Well, interesting stuff about sake. I've talked about sake before, but this is much more in depth. This is a much better episode about sake. Good for us. Let's see, sake 101, sake savi, sake. Sake. Okay. I think we've got how to build a sake career. I don't think anybody wants to build a career in sake out there. If you do, get a hold of me and I'll get you in touch with Matt and you can find out how to do it. But otherwise, I think we're done with sake tonight. Well, thank you, Matt, for getting us on this trip.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Different kind of beverage. With similar, I don't know. There's some similarities there between the two I never knew about. So, very cool.
Yeah. It's strange stuff. I mean, there's so many little things. And I'm sure as you start making it and stuff, there's things that you really have to watch and be sure the balance is right. And then, like Matt said, the water is the most essential of all of it. That was interesting.
Okay. Well, we are, I guess, at just after 8 o'clock on this show, which is August 22nd. And I don't know, did you say we had a guest next week? Or was it? I know we talked about September.
This is what's happening next week, and I need to talk to you more after the show here because we need to how we're going to have the guy call in, what we're going to do. We have a special edition Sunday at 1 o'clock, a special episode of All About Wine coming up this Sunday at 1 o'clock. And this our guest then is going to be find his name here. Where is his name? Well, I can see the wine all over the place. You didn't put the name down here. Oh, yeah. Bodvar Hofstrom of Bodvar Rosé and Nolo Consumer Trends. It's non-alcohol and low-alcohol beverages, Bovar Rosé. This is the original letter I got, and it says, "Hope all is well. Reaching out as I've been working with Bodvar, B-O-D-V-A-R, a leader in the rosé wine industry and creators of National Rosé Day." National Rosé Day is, I have no idea. I thought it was, it was the 14th last week. Recent consumer trends in the alcohol industry, undergoing a significant transformation as the no-alcohol, low-alcohol trend, referred to as NOLO, reshapes consumer preferences. Bodvar caters to the health-conscious, mindful drinkers of today while maintaining the exceptional quality and flavor Bodvar Rosé is known for. I'd love for you to chat with Bodvar. And he is in Europe, exactly. Where, but we have him scheduled for the 22nd, and he can't make it then. He's wondering if they can do it at a different time. And I said, we could do a Sunday. They wanted to do a Saturday morning, and I said, no, that's not possible. But I told him we can do a Sunday at 1 o'clock, and they were all for that. And they're all set. They're 6 hours ahead of us from Eastern time, so... France, in that area there, they're 6 hours ahead of us. The Olympics was 6 hours ahead of us. So we are set. 1 o'clock Sunday will be our live show, and then we'll replay it on Thursday the 29th in our regular time slot. So I just received an email while we were on the show tonight, as a matter of fact. I told him I would find out what we're going to do, what call in, because we are looking at something else. And she said, touching base here to see if you have the dial-in information for Sunday. So that's going to be what's happening this next week. We are going to do the live show on Sunday. It'll be a rebroadcast on Thursday. And so, but most you people out there listen to it on archives anyway, which is cool. I don't mind. That's, you know, won't you listen? I'm happy. So that's what's coming up this next week here. Or actually Sunday and then Thursday. But Mike and I are going to discuss the call-in information, hopefully, after we say goodnight to you.
All right. Yeah, I got to load a couple of things, but figure out what the connection is. Okay. We'll talk to you all Sunday. Tune into a special live show on Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time right here on Blog Talk Radio and everywhere else you're listening to us now. And we'll talk to you then. Thanks for tuning in tonight. Have a safe rest of the week, weekend, and we'll talk to you next time on All About Wine.
All About
Wine. Here we go. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
Okay, I'm going here real quick. Set up. I had.